This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. This half hour is brought to you by Larson & Larson. They are my intellectual property lawyers, and they probably should be yours because they are really great. And on Thursday, I have Bill Larson coming in, and I call him the writer's legal eagle because he knows everything that you need when it comes to intellectual property. And if you've been listening to some of the interviews over the past few months, I've been talking to authors, and even the most famous authors have made serious mistakes that have cost them money. And even if they've won the cases, which they have, they still ended up paying a lot of money because of legal fees. So it's something for you to consider. If you think that you have a question about your legal rights or what you need to do, you should contact Larson & Larson. And if you know, sometimes we say, oh, well, I don't really need to do that. But you could live to regret it, because there are a lot of things out there nowadays, especially with the internet. Plagiarism is running rampant lately. And so it's all sorts of things that you need to know to protect your rights. If you have a question for Bill, you can write me at patsy.radio@gmail.com. And it's Patsy, P-A-T-Z-I, and dot radio. And I will be happy to give the question to Bill when he comes into the studio on Thursday. You could even call in on Thursday when we I will open the phone line. So it's just something for you to think about. What do you have to know about your legal rights? And I will just say one thing. Do not sign anything without a lawyer. So, anyway, I'm so excited today. I have in the studio with me two fantastic writers, part of our new fantastic writers showcase at the Book Nook, Miami Avenue Book Nook in Indian Rocks Beach. And tomorrow is the grand opening of the Book Nook. And so it's really great for me to have two of the writers who have joined the group, Sebastian Roberts and Charles Fortin. Hi. First, Sebastian, hi.
Good morning.
Okay, good morning. And Charles, can I call you Chuck?
You may.
Okay.
Patsy, thank you very much. It's fascinating and very interesting and a privilege to be with such knowledgeable people.
Well, it's fun to have you guys in here because as I've been talking over the past few months, we got the idea for the Book Nook because we have so many really fantastic authors in our area, and it's an opportunity for you to have your books there. And also over the next, starting in the fall, starting in late September, we're going to have events at the Book Nook. We're going to have different speakers. We're going to have author opportunities to meet the public. And so it's going to be lots of fun to promote books. And now both of you have it's funny, you both have similar backgrounds. You've both been consultants for the governments and have done a lot of technical writing. And Sebastian, you, of course, have taken your knowledge and your background and turned it into novels.
Yes, I have.
Which are fun. And I among the novels, I've read Serenity and Dragonfly, and I know you just brought in a new book for me, The Writer. And I love Dragonfly.
Well, I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah. You know, it is such a timely book because it opens up. It opens up. The first thing you read is November 2016. So we know we're in election season. So that was a clever idea. And the story is about somebody who's elected president. So you want to tell us a little bit about it, but don't give away the end. It is fantastic. It's a fun read.
Yeah, I won't give away the ending.
No, you can't. Or even some of the middle, because it's fun.
I actually finished that in 2014 before anyone had declared that they were going to run for president. But I could see that it was going to be an exciting year.
Well, you got that right.
So it's the fictional story of Madison Thompson, who runs for president, and his running mate, Janice Edmonds. They win in a fluke kind of an election. They weren't expected to win at all. And the main part of the story is the transition from the current administration to the administration that Madison and Janice are going to build.
And there are a lot of twists and turns in this book, and it's good. And of course, you talk about a lot of very timely subjects and questions that are on people's mind. And so you have a background in, tell us a little bit about your background so we know where all this information you've got in this book comes from.
Well, I guess the main contributions to my background is my education, British prep school, college in Texas, doctoral degree from USF, and served as a military intelligence officer and then as a consultant. And with all of those different things, you get different perspectives on things. And so it becomes a little bit easier to look at something from multiple angles and be able to see that this situation is not necessarily as it's presented in the press or whatever. And what I tried to do in Dragonfly was to present those situations, but in a way that's not dry and dull and boring. So I had to weave in a lot of interpersonal relationships among the actors in the book, and just keep it interesting, because the fact of the matter is politics can be pretty dull. So you need to have that those other little stories to liven it up, because while politics is dull, living in a political world is not dull at all.
No,
because there's always something weird going on.
And you managed to capture a lot of the weirdness. It's really, as I said, it's a fun read. And of course, you have a great interest in the Constitution. And
yes.
I understand that you had been teaching about the Constitution. So it's an important part of the book.
Yes, it is. It's an important part of our lives. And like I said, I'm not going to ruin the ending. No. But what happens is... Madison and Janice go right up to the point where they get where the inauguration, and a couple of weeks after that, and then some weird stuff happens.
Weird stuff happens, but as I said, it's a great book. And then, as I was talking earlier to you, now in this book, you mentioned Janice, and she's a recurring character in another of your books.
Yes.
And that one, it's another book that I really like, because... It's got a part there about, now you weren't a Marine, but it's
I was in the Navy.
You were a Navy guy. So why'd you write about a Marine?
Well, I had pet Marines when I was in the Navy.
Okay, that's well, yes, okay.
As an intelligence officer, I had a Marine assigned to me. I'm not sure if he was there to protect me or kill me if I got out of line, but he, you know, I had a Marine.
Okay, well, that's good. I love that, a pet Marine. Okay, I know a few Marines. I'm going to tell that to you.
Oh, I tell them all the time.
Oh, yeah. They're fun. No, that's cute, because my boys always thought of me a little bit as a drill sergeant. I had that ability, and I love the scene. I always love, in a book, I always love boot camp scenes, because I always imagine that I would have been such a great drill sergeant, and I love that scene in the book.
Well, were you in the service?
No, I wasn't. When I was that age, there weren't a lot of women in the service, so I didn't do it, but I joined today, actually. I loved it.
Well, we had,
boss people
we had in boot camp in the Navy, our drill sergeants were Marines. And I'm 60-some-odd years old now, and I will tell you that those Marine drill sergeants were the most professional, most focused, most goal-oriented people, and they knew exactly what they were doing. And basically, take an 18-year-old or a 20-year-old apart piece by piece, and you reassemble them into an officer. And they were good at it.
That's why that part of the book is so realistic. And I read that part twice because I liked it so much. I thought that was so cool. You did a great job.
That's based on real experience.
Based on real experience. And so a lot of this stuff, I think, is based on real experience.
Well, you know, you're supposed to write about what you know about, right?
That's right. So you had some interesting experiences in your life. And I can't let this go without... before I get back to Chuck, I have to ask about this prep school, because when I first heard about it, I thought, oh, well, that's cool, because I lived in England for many years, and I lived in a little village called Sonning, and just outside the village we had a boys' prep school, a public school, as they call it over there, and it was, I always found it so delightful that the little boys would come in to the village, and they'd come to the sweet shop, and they would speak Latin, and, you know, it's just to impress all the natives. But they were always so sweet to me because I was the one American, and they always wanted to hear about America. So they talk English to me, which was, oh, wow, that was sweet. So, but you went to prep school, but not in England. How did that happen?
I'm curious. I wonder if they taught English or spoke English or spoke British to you.
Well.
Because there's a difference.
Yes, that's true.
But to answer your question, the story that I was told by the people that ran the school was that there was a group of businessmen in the late 50s, early 60s, who were very disenchanted with the educational system in St. Louis. And so they got together and they raised enough money.
Can you imagine what would happen today?
They raised enough money and they bought a British prep school taught by Benedictine monks. They brought the monks and everything over here. They built the school. And the only condition that the monks put on it was that just because they contributed to the fund, it didn't mean their kids would actually be admitted. They had to earn their admission anyway. So it was very straight up kind of a deal. And it was a 6-year program. You had to start in the seventh grade. And the British monks really are very good educators.
Oh, yes, they are. They are. That's fantastic. I think it's wonderful. Probably we could learn a lot from them when it comes to education nowadays. Well, so Chuck, let's talk a little bit about your background. You actually did study in England. You studied in Brighton.
I did. I'm a Midwesterner. I grew up near Chicago and did undergraduate work at Notre Dame and then urban planning at Wisconsin, and then much later international development at the University of Sussex and near Brighton.
Okay, well, I'm just holding up your book to anybody who's watching on the internet. And it is called Rites of Way to Brasilia Te Moça.
Exactly.
Okay, well, you know, everything Brazilian is in our minds at this point, so I think it's a timely book. Now, your book is not fiction. It's a nonfiction. It's actually a very serious book, a very, very weighty book. And tell us a little bit about how you got involved and what the book is about.
Well, writ large, as an introduction, it's really the conflict of urban development and gentrification against slum dwellers in Brazil. And this is what's happened in Brazilian cities routinely before the World Cup just 2 years ago, and now just prior to the Olympics in Rio. A number of these neighborhoods have been devastated and removed so that sports arenas and accommodations for students can be erected. So it's the conflict of between essentially government action and poor people trying to maintain their livelihoods and the places where they're living.
Well, they managed, I think, quite well in this during the Olympics not to show us really any of the poverty. It was really, I think the press was quite disciplined. I don't know who disciplined them, but they quite disciplined in not showing us the actual utter poverty
I'm told that a wall was built between the airport and the neighboring slums, so people who were arriving from out of country wouldn't have the visual pollution of poor people living in shacks.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, so that's, I think, and many of the foreigners stayed on ships outside so that they wouldn't actually even be in town. And it's such a tragedy. I mean, when you read about it, it's horrific. It's really hard to believe. But you lived there for 20 years in this area, and you...
Yes, after college, I thought I'd do some good in the world, so I decided to go into the Peace Corps, and I learned Portuguese, and went down there and lived in the middle of a slum for 2 years. I actually helped to build the mud hut that I lived in that had no electricity and had one light bulb hanging from the ceiling, but there was no water and no toilets, and it was a very, very, very poor neighborhood. And I tried to, I don't know, on second thought, maybe I shouldn't have gone to such extremes, but I tried to immerse myself with the local community to feel their problems and to try to work with them to do some community improvements.
Well, that's actually a very brave thing to do, because I wouldn't do it, but that was hard. Weren't you scared? I mean, you were young then. And
it was actually the first time that I flew on an airplane was when I was 24, because I lived in the Midwest, and everything I need to go to, I could get to by car. So when I was invited to go to the Peace Corps, when I was 24, actually, the first plane ride I ever took was from Chicago to New York, and then another plane up to New Hampshire, and then Brattleboro, Vermont, where we had Peace Corps training. And we spent six weeks there learning Portuguese and Brazilian culture. And then we flew down to Brazil, where we trained for another 6 weeks. And then we were just dumped into our sites.
A real immersion.
To make the best of what we could do. So it was, they were supposed to have some institutional connections for us and some linkages and some networks. But actually, in the end, everyone had to fend for themselves and just make the best of what they had and learn about the community and see what could be done to help them along.
And so you built your own mud hut.
I was living in a very bad little house next door. Then one morning I woke up and there was my future landlord was building another house. And so what they do is he had some rough-hewn posts on each corner and in the middle. And then between the posts, they wired two layers of sticks, and then between the sticks we packed, then I was already part of the construction team by then, and with a bunch of little kids in the neighborhood, we packed the walls between the sticks with clay. And then once that dried, then he would come in and put a thin coat of cement just to kind of smooth out the walls. And I paid a young friend to fetch water for me from the public faucet up the street. I had to boil the water in a pot. Then I placed it in a ceramic water filter just to make sure it was clean enough. I needed a mosquito net to keep the bugs out at night. And when I came home in the evening, it was very dark. So with my flashlight, I would check out under my cot, in the corners, up in the rafters, to see if there were any coiled snakes waiting to greet me during the night.
Okay. Okay. You really went all the way in for this.
Well, just okay. What was I doing there for 2 years?
Yeah, that's what I wanted.
I worked at many jobs. We filled potholes in the muddy road there. We showed films and taught health to kids and adults. Organized a social club, supported youth soccer team, and most importantly, I set up for 2 years an evening adult literacy program in the neighborhood, and four local teachers were trained, and I administered that program.
Now, how many people were there in this area that you were assigned to? I mean, how many? What are we talking about?
Yeah, well, the town itself was about, depending on it, probably about 15,000 people, and it was about 90 minutes bus ride from the state capital of Salvador, which is in the state of Bahia in northeast Brazil. So in this small town, I lived in essentially a mud flat neighborhood that was just a tentacle, just a one section of that town. So there wasn't. It was the bad end of town in terms of hygiene, and there was mosquitoes and rats and all kinds of critters that would. And it was also, there were places on the huts where you could see where floodwaters had in the past had come up, 4 or 5 feet. So it was prone to floods as well. Not when I was there, but the annual rainfall was about 90 inches a year, so it rained a lot, and the street was muddy. And
so that's where part of this, part of your book talks a lot about
that
urban development and control of floodwaters and things like that, yeah. Right?
Those are the circumstances in the context of my initial contact with Brazil and the Peace Corps. Later, I came back to the States and did some more schooling. Then I I worked in Jacksonville, actually, in urban planning for a couple of years. And then I went back to Brazil for another 17 years and taught urban planning at the university. And it was during that time, in a different city in the Northeast, Recife, where I discovered, to my surprise, this neighborhood that shouldn't exist. It's between an elite, fancy neighborhood. Let's compare it to the South Beach of Miami and the downtown. And it was in the middle. And it should have been, by all accounts, it should have been totally wiped out and destroyed and become a premier waterfront property for expensive housing and hotels. And actually, there were many attempts over the 50-year period that I studied this neighborhood where there were concrete plans to put in 5 international hotels, SeaWorld, Convention Center. And the story of the book is the fact that, against all odds, these people were able to organize and resist all of these attempts and eventually succeed in maintaining their neighborhood, which became increasingly, since they had security of tenure finally, they can invest more in their house without fear of being removed forcefully by the government.
And what's the situation there now?
The situation has it's the same. The same relatively poor people are living there. Some of the homes have been upgraded, although there are strict restrictions on what can be built. And you do have some, as I understand it, some not middle class but working class people who now live there, because it's just across the river from downtown and all kinds of jobs. So it's an ideal location for people to save money for transportation and maintain the community.
Okay, well, and as I said, this is a nonfiction book, and we're going to take a quick break, and then when I come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about writing in general and about fiction and why Chuck here has to write a book. Okay, we'll be back in a few minutes.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Looking for a good book? Then get over to Miami Avenue Book Nook in Indian Rocks Beach. Check out the latest books from local authors like Angela Hunt, who wrote the book for the film Risen, or Bonsu Brenvick, whose books preserve the memories of the Bellevue Biltmore Hotel. What do you enjoy reading? A thriller? A romance? How about a mystery or a sci-fi? At the Book Nook, you'll find it all. Remember, one of the joys of life is to read. Located in Indian Rocks Beach, look for the blue building with the mermaid on the side, on the corner of Miami Avenue and 2nd Street, 2 blocks south of the post office. Open Tuesday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. and Saturday, noon to 4. And don't forget, while you're there, check out Miami Avenue's great collection of Florida wines, local art, and fantastic gifts. Miami Avenue Book Nook, where you will be inspired to read.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Are you looking for the perfect gift? Going to a wedding? A special birthday? The Silver Queen is the place to go. Don't settle for the ordinary. At the Silver Queen, you will find a unique gift. Things that you won't find at the mall. From beautiful photo frames to silver and china. Guys, looking for that perfect ring? You'll find it at the Silver Queen. And don't forget their bridal registry. Located at 1350 West Bay Drive in Largo. Visit their website, silverqueen.com. They have some wonderful coupons. And when you go to the store, tell them that Patsy with a Z sent you.
Looking for a good book? Whether you want the latest bestseller or a rare book, Haslam's Bookstore at 2025 Central Avenue in downtown St. Petersburg is the place to visit. Haslam's has been in business for over 70 years and is the largest new and used bookstore in Florida. With 30,000 square feet and over 300,000 books, you'll find just the right book for you. Bestsellers, cookbooks, military, history, and so much more. Check out their website, www.haslams.com, to find out about their special events. Remember, Haslam's, one of Florida's true treasures, 2025 Central Avenue in St. Petersburg, and they're open on Sundays from noon to 5.
Tampa Bay's Tan Talk, entertaining and informative radio for the Sunshine State.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my guests in the studio, Sebastian Roberts and Charles Fortin, both writers who are now whose books are now going to be available at the Miami Avenue Book Nook. And tomorrow is a grand opening of the Book Nook in Indian Rocks Beach. It's at 1 p.m., so if you're around, come and join us. And there will be, I hope both of you guys are going to be there.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And we have some other wonderful authors who are going to be there. Angela Hunt, who wrote the novelization for Risen and, of course, so many other fantastic books. And I think she sold now over 5 million books. And Carol J. Perry, whose Witch City Mysteries are just so much fun. They are fantastic, cozy mysteries. And I know she's going to be joining us. And, of course, Bansu Brandvik, who is the absolutely fantastic writer who writes the books that have been... she wrote them to preserve the history of the Bellevue Biltmore Hotel, and her first two books are out, and they're available at the Book Nook, and she's working busily on her third one. So I'm looking forward to seeing Bansu there tomorrow, too. So I want to get back to, for a minute, I'm just going to get back to Chuck and say that, Chuck, you've got so much, such a fascinating story, and you've done so many fascinating things, that now what you have to do is start writing a novel.
Right. There was actually all the field work that was done for actually my initial dissertation, which was about 500 pages with all the theory and the academic jargon. But I wanted to extract from that the story devoid of all that heaviness so that it would be much more accessible. But now, just in our conversations here, I'm seeing that I'm heading toward writing perhaps a historical or a fictional novel based on some of the bones and the facts and the field work that I've done. But this the book has an evolution. I essentially finished the dissertation in 30 years ago, and I haven't worked on it. You know, why was it just published a year or two ago? Well, I was at the university, so I was writing research papers, and then when I moved to Washington, I was writing other government reports, and so I was totally distracted from, and didn't even think that I could, you know, make this happen. But then one day, I convinced myself that I would at least give it a try. And so I started writing, and I wrote about 140 pages of very boring pieces that was mostly a narrative of the story. And then so I set it aside again. And then one day I realized that I had a whole cardboard box of cassette tapes of the live interviews that I had done with the main characters of my book. So I retrieved those, and I weaved them into the story. They were originally done in Portuguese, so I had one of these foot pedal operations where you could transcribe, and then so I listened to the English, and then I kind of paraphrase it I listened to it in Portuguese and then paraphrase it in English, and then weave in some dialogue into the story so that people's live depositions are, you know, recorded forever. So, and then it became more alive.
Well, you've got the resources here for a great novel, and I know that when now you're going to start writing that, and another gentleman who was in the Peace Corps, David Edmonds, wrote a fantastic book about his time in the Peace Corps, and it's called Lily of Peru, a great book, and so you should read that and get some inspiration from him. He has a writer's group right up here, up the road somewhere, not too far away from the studio, and this is what's so fantastic. Now, you know, I don't know, Sebastian, when did you start writing? When you retired?
That's when I started, actually. Basically, I have a similar profile. The first book I wrote, Day 183, I wrote back in 1976 when I was in the Navy, but it never went anywhere. So I'd always been interested in writing, but I had my other careers to do first, and so I would get a little story and I'd sketch the outline or whatever. And so when I did retire in 2014, I had all of these plot lines all ready to go, and all I had to do was sit down and write them. Excuse me. But the when I started writing in earnest was about 2 years ago. Yeah.
Well, the nice thing about guys like you who have done technical writing and are well educated, it's all the grammar and the punctuation and all that comes more easily to you.
More easily, but not perfectly.
Not perfectly.
Well, and there's a big transition between technical writing and fictional writing, and I'm making initiatives in that direction. But it's difficult to think more imaginatively when I've been working with fact-based reports and things. So there is it's like if you know Spanish, it's Portuguese is similar, but it's still not the same. So there is a transition.
Oh, there's a transition. There's a transition, but it does help. It really does. Yeah. Believe me, because I know so many, writers who are starting off. They have the story to tell, but they don't have any experience in writing, and so they have a double learning experience.
Yes, but they'll never get experience if they don't go ahead and tell the story.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So they have to do both, so it makes it easier. And of course, the best thing is to read authors like Clive Cussler, who is a fantastic author, and to anyone who with like your backgrounds, of course, I don't know if you've read Clive Cussler, but he of course was big into scuba diving
As a Maui scuba instructor, I found some of his diving scenes rather interesting.
I'm sure, but at least what he did is fantastic. Is that he wrote, so it was really nice. I had him for his 85th birthday on the program.
But it also takes a lot of humility. I'm part of the Dunedin Writers Group, mm-hmm. and I'll go in there because I'm just kind of beginning in the fiction part. I'll go in there with little vignettes and sorts, and it can be a bit humiliating and disheartening at times. So some days are better than others, but it's a trial and error, and we'll get there.
Well, you learn from it. You learn, and it's a fantastic experience. We have so many wonderful writers groups in the area. The one that David Edmonds and Wayne McDowell have up in Tarpon Springs, the Dunedin one, and of course, one of the best one is Bonsu Brandvik's meetup writers group. She is amazing. She has a fantastic group. I think she's gotten several hundred people who participate on sort of routine basis, and she's really been able to help a lot of writers get focused, and that's a wonderful thing.
Can I offer something about the writers groups?
Yeah,
I started to get involved in a couple of writers groups, and I'm a member of two of them now. For anybody who's listening and is interested in getting involved in a writers group, what I learned is that each writers group has its own personality, and if that personality doesn't match yours, you need to go find a different group.
Exactly.
Yeah, some of them can be. Well, very different from
you. Oh yeah, you can find all sorts, and you can get into one group where you'll always have somebody who nitpicks on every little thing, but in a way, especially like if you're in a writers group where you show you hand out printouts of your work, and so everybody gets to read it during the writers group, and you'll always find somebody who will see every comma and every dash, M dash, N dash, and they'll jump on that. And so somebody who's just starting off will say, oh, I don't know all of that stuff. I don't know all of that stuff. But in a way it's sort of helpful because then you do become aware that there is such a thing as, the right kind of dash and the wrong kind of dash and the wrong kind of parenthesis. And it has its benefits.
Well, the best group that I have is don't do that at all. It's a group of people, and there's about 15 or 20 that come together. And every week, all they do is they go around the room and say, what did you do this week? So you don't read, you don't pass out your stuff, but it keeps you moving. So every week you have to say, I wrote 2,000 words, or I wrote 10 pages, or I made this much progress. And, you know, it keeps going.
Yeah, that's fun. Are you one of these writers who get up early every morning and write so many words?
Define early. Missouri farm boy. 4:30 is
fourth.
Is morning.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and that's about the time that to me is morning too. I love to be up at, well, I love to be up at 4:30. I do that a lot, and for years I was working on a project called the Forgotten F-105 Warrior Project, and I particularly love that time because the F-105s used to, which were based in Thailand during the Vietnam War, and these pilots were, you know, just amazing pilots, and that's the time they'd be on the flight line at 4:30 in the morning and be taking off and heading out for their bombing first day bombing run, and so it was just so I actually would play the soundtrack from the flight line. Because I just love that feeling of being up so early in the morning and working. So I noticed that you said you were a scoutmaster too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was a scoutmaster at a troop in South St. Petersburg for about 10, 12 years.
Yeah. Okay.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, both of my boys were Eagle Scouts. So
good.
And so my husband spent a lot of time working as a scoutmaster and working with the boys, and that was.
It's very rewarding to. Take these young gentlemen and help them develop.
Oh, it's a fantastic thing, and we enjoyed those scouting years so much. Talking about snakes, I was deeply involved in the scouting and travel and did all of the trips until they got really old. When it would be silly for mommy to go along, but I did all of the campouts, and I loved it until we went to a little place up We lived in Texas, and so I went to all of them. And then we moved here to Florida, and we went up to one a little north of here, and they had snakes. Oh my gosh! And I thought, okay, I think my sleeping out in tent days are over, because we didn't. In Texas, I never had any problem with snakes, but here I get to Florida and I got snakes. So I said, but you know, that's an opening, good opening, Chuck, for your book. I can see the opening of your book. You, whatever.
Can I just copy that down?
Yeah, and you're going,
how would I begin again?
your hero, we don't know his name yet, yeah. But you're going to come out with a really great name. Sort of like Sebastian Roberts is a great name for a writer. You're going to come out with a really great name.
Well,
and
thank you.
Your hero is going to be searching a mud hut with a flashlight for snakes. That's
excellent.
The opening.
I appreciate the encouragement.
This is the opening. I can see it now. And
I'm inspired.
You better be inspired. And so that in a year from now, when you have the book published, you'll come back here. And,
absolutely.
And we can talk about it, because that's always a good good way to open a book. So are you having fun, Sebastian, with all of this writing?
I'll be perfectly honest. I enjoy the writing very, very, very much. But the other side of the business of
it. Oh, the business side. Oh, don't we just love the business.
Try and get a publicist. You try to get an agent. You try to get your books sold. You put them in a bookstore, things like that. Can be tiring.
It can be tiring. It can be exhausting. It can be frustrating. And well, that's one of the things that I'm hoping to work with writers in the local writers and of course, the people, the writers that I reach on the radio, and I do want to thank all the listeners. I've got some listeners, you know, who watch on the internet, and I'm waving to them now, and all the way to the state of Washington, I have in Idaho and California, and these are our writers that I've met over the years, over the 18 months since I started this program at writers festivals and conferences, and so they've put out the word, you know, to get my show out there, because I love to bring in people who advise writers, and one of the people I like, I have to think for a minute. Irene Goodman. Irene Goodman is an agent, and she is a fantastic agent, and she's been on the program twice, and she's coming back on September 22nd. And she is a fantastic resource for information about what publishers are looking for and what's happening in the market. And she also, you know, it's very, when you're a writer, as you were saying, Sebastian, it's so much fun to write, but it's such a pain to have to deal with all of the other things. But unfortunately, you have no choice nowadays. You know, even if you're published by a major publisher, it's still up to you to get out there and sell your books.
Well, that's what's so great about what Bev is doing at the Miami Wine Bar, is because my personal library is about 6,000 volumes in my house. And yes, I've read them all. But when you look at who are on the bestseller lists right now, a lot of them happen to be, sadly, formulaic. So you pick up, and I won't mention any names, you pick up a popular writer, and you know what's going to be inside. But I'll tell you, I've read a number of books from the other authors that are going to be out there at the wine bar, and what I've read from them is better than, you know, a lot of the front-running authors that I've picked up at the bookstore.
Well, and that is true. That's why it's so much fun to find an author who's not, you know, out of the ordinary. And that's why when I was reading your books, first of all, I think they're great. And as I said, I really think everybody should buy Dragonfly at this time. This, you know, before the election, mm-hmm. Buy it and read it. Dragonfly is really a fun read, and it's really we're in this political season and you're thinking about all of these subjects. And there, 2 years ago, you were already thinking about it. Sebastian already had all this in his mind. I don't know. And many of the things are so, so perfectly timed. And Dragonfly is a really fun read. And when you read it, you think, oh, wow, I found an author who's got a different take on things. So I really hope that people will get out there and get it, and it's available on Amazon and, of course, now at the Book Nook.
And on Nook. Nook and Kindle editions are available. They're on sale now for $2.
Okay. You have to get it for that price. You have to get it. Absolutely.
Get a hard copy from my website.
Okay. Your website is?
TomCuba.net, TomCuba.net.
Okay. So you can get the hardback copy there or at the Book Nook. And absolutely. You have to buy it on Kindle or Nook. I love the Nook. I'm going to have the Barnes & Noble girl, the local, I don't know, she's a community relations person for the area on Thursday. She's going to be joining me here in the studio.
Is that Liz?
Huh?
Liz?
No, Kathy.
Oh.
And so it's just wonderful that we're going to be talking about actually the Nook. And so one of the things that it's so much fun to be able to read books on Kindle and Nook. That's a ridiculous price because it's a good book. And
thank you.
I think it's just so much fun. I get a kick out of it every time I think about it. And what's this other book that you brought into the studio today for me? The Writer.
The Writer.
This book about? Same characters?
No. This is a whole different set of characters. I decided to do something strange.
Okay.
So it's about a guy who gets to be 40 years old, and he's worked as a toll booth attendant his whole life, but he always wanted to be a writer. So he gets to the point where he can retire, work on his state pension, and he gets a tablet, and he starts this process of learning how to write. And he's got an English degree, but he's never really gotten into it. He's always been the one who was afraid to do anything. So he's got these success problems. He doesn't feel like he's good enough, and he has to overcome all of that stuff as he goes through it. So he actually develops an alter ego so that his alter ego can have the confidence to do the things that he never had the confidence to do. So then the alter ego goes out and he gets all these experiences, and like I said before, you write about what you know about. So the main character, Wally, he's never done anything. He can't write anything. But his alter ego goes out and rents a fast car and, you know, sails a boat. And he gets all these experiences so the alter ego can become the writer.
Well, that sounds like fun. Oh, I know I'm going to have fun with this one. And that's exactly what you were saying, that to have a book that it's different. And it as a reader, it's so wonderful to be able to find you almost feel like you're on a treasure hunt here when you find a writer that talks to you and that just brings out some new ideas in your head. Talking about a toll booth guy, I don't know if anybody knows who this guy is. There is there was for years a toll booth guy down at the toll booth that's there opposite the Don Cesar Hotel. And there was this toll booth guy. And this is just what I talk about when I say share the joy. And this guy, for years, I went through this toll booth and he's just to see him every day, just to see his face every day, was a joy. He was so, always so nice. And, I mean, you know, you could say, what's so great about being a toll booth driver? He just gave people joy. It was absolutely delightful. And to see somebody like that, so this is going to be a fun read. Have a toll booth guy who has an alter personality.
it was fun to write because you can imagine, you know, being in the toll booth, the different people you see go past every day, and every one of them has a story. And what I said before about writing what you know about, I don't want to discourage people because from writing their own story, because everybody has done something worth writing about.
That's true. That's true. And that's what I tried to tell everyone. Get out there and, you know, if whether you're going to start with a nonfiction book, if you have a job, as whatever you are, you know, I met an insurance man and he wanted to know, well, what should he do to, you know, if he wanted to go ahead in his career to be different from everybody else. And he was wondering if he could write a book. I said, well, why can't you write a book? He said, well, I don't know if I can write a book. I said, well, write the book, you know, just try. And so he's working on a book. It's about the insurance industry, but it's going to set him apart from everybody else. When he goes to these insurance seminars, you know, where there are 1,000 people, he is going to have a book with him that he wrote. And it's the same whether you're, a lawyer or a doctor or whatever. If you've written a book, it's just puts you up a notch. And so all of you out there can write a book. And of course, there's so many of you who have interesting family stories. And to write a memoir, whether it's just a collection of stories or you weave it together as a novel, it's really fantastic, and it preserves memories for your family. And even some of you out there, I know you have interesting stories and interesting families. You can get together with your brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles. And nowadays, it's so nice that you can put together a book, and you can self-publish a book like that, and it will be there forever for your family to have. So. So I just love when people get out there and get inspired, and I know that now Chuck is here, absolutely inspired, and he's going to start waking up at 4:30 every morning and getting his, Ernest Hemingway wanted to do 800 words a day, and he did it, it's very clever, he did it standing up, you know, he didn't sit down when he wrote, he had his typewriter on a tall table, and he would stand and type, and his goal was always to have 800 words a day. And so, you know, if you do that, you're going to get somewhere. So he was ahead of his time in that idea of standing up to type. I have to try to do that. I have to get one of those desks where you can stand up. I have to figure out how to do that, fit that in, because it can be done, and they say it's so much better for you. So. That's something to consider. But anyway, I want to thank everyone for, I want to thank you guys for coming in today, and I want to thank everyone who's been involved in the grand opening of the Miami Avenue Book Nook and all the preparation that's gone into it. And it's just fun to be able to find a new author. So for all of you readers, come on down tomorrow or anytime during the week just find a book and find a new author. And sometime in the fall, we're going to have a list of the different author events and times that you can come in and meet the authors and talk to the authors and also get advice from authors and from people involved in the industry about what you need to do in order to get your book written and get out there and be part of the whole fantastic Florida authors groups that I hope, not just here, I hope that we can open book nooks in other locations around, because there are so many fantastic local authors, and it's nice to encourage them. So that's one of the things that's happening. And meanwhile, anything else?
That I wanted to mention that the Miami Avenue wine is on Indian Rocks Beach.
That's right.
And make sure that people knew that's where they got to go.
That's right. It's in Indian Rocks Beach. It's that back road parallel to behind Krabby Bill's and just one block south of the Indian Rocks post office. And it's a beautiful, beautiful place. And you can recognize it. There's a big, big mermaid on the side of the building. And it's a wonderful location. And it's going to be a wonderful location for writers to have writers meetups and different book signings and parties and events. And so it's something to look forward to in the fall. I want to thank both of you guys for coming in today.
Thank you.
It's really great. And
I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, it's been fun. And Chuck, I'm working. I write screenplays, so I'm already working. I'm already thinking okay. ahead of
let's
you. You have to finish the book.
Let's collaborate.
I will work on the screenplay. And, Sebastian, I love it. I have to just tell everyone again, get Dragonfly. It is a great book, and it's a great book to read particularly at this time. It's just, you will find it really a fun read.
Thank you very much.
So I want to thank you so much. And remember, everyone, join me on Thursday for the Writers Legal Eagle, Bill Larson. He's going to be here in the studio, and then on September 8th, Bill and I are going to be giving a big, big speech downtown at the main library in St. Petersburg. And it's going to be a really fun event because we're going to do talk about all sorts of wonderful lawsuits that different people have gotten into and a lot of gossip about the whole industry. And so it's going to be a fun event. And that's going to be on September 8th. But join me on Thursday at 11 o'clock right here on Tan Talk Radio, and we will talk about legal matters. Meanwhile, share the joy and just have a fun day, and hope to see you tomorrow in Indian Rocks Beach. Bye for now.
WTAN, Clearwater, Tampa Bay. WDCF, Dade City, Tampa Bay. WZHR, Zephyr Hills, Tampa Bay.
President in Louisiana, soldier dead in Afghanistan. I'm Chaz Henry. President Obama's in Baton Rouge today, touring the flood-ravaged city.